Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS, better known as Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. Let me drop for a second, and I'll give you the usual links. Okay, very good. If you need to reach me and you can't get me through the repeater, then email is the way to go. That would be either for questions, mailbag questions we used to call them, or topics you would like to discuss or have discussed, or if you have any puzzles. I always like technical puzzles, give people a little bit of a start in thinking about things and talking about subjects that we once knew and thought we remembered but may not have remembered completely. Or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder as well with some space or NASA-related story, you'd like Paul's slant on it, you could, of course, get him directly. His email is spacenetreport@gmail.com. But if you would like to contact me, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. I have a link page with all kinds of interesting YouTubes and articles, and sometimes as the TechNet progresses and people bring up subjects, I will add to that. The links are available 24/7. You just type into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to my link page. We have a chat room. You can either go to Limark's own website, find the link, click it, and go into the chat room, or you can just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that will give you an alias to our chat room and bring you there. Also, I stream the TechNet, and because of some people wanting the stream available at other times, I stream it approximately 24/7. So if you are out of radio access for the Glen Oaks repeater, but you still like to listen in to what's going on, if you have Internet access, type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you a stream, an audio stream of our repeater. And as always, I'd like to remind people of MikeKC2NJI's wonderful archive site, amateurradio.tv. He has archived the technical nets going as far back as September of 2006, and they're a great source of wisdom from many of the amateur radio operators that still participate to this day, and unfortunately those that have become silent keys through the years. So let me drop for a moment, and I'll give you my my plan for tonight. Okay, planning on a standard edition of our pre-Christmas episode of the Limark Technical Net. I will ask for questions and topics from the audience. Hopefully the first few will be amateur radio related. And for people out there who are a little bit annoyed that it takes me so long to get to the fourth or fifth question, just be a little bit faster on the trigger when I do this and get your name higher up on the list. So we will ask for questions of a technical nature. I will take their people's first names and call signs, and we'll try and address them in order. Once we get past all the amateur radio-related questions, we'll open the net for any science or technology question. And if you want to discuss medicine, as long as we do not discuss diagnosis nor treatment, I'm open for that as well. That should take us to approximately 10:15, where Paul will come in, WS2N, with the SpaceNet report. That will continue until about 11 o'clock. I will return, tie a bow on it, wish you well, and call it a week. So that's the plan, if all the little pieces of hardware and software allow me to do so. So with that in mind, please hit that push-to-talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign if you have any questions or topics of discussion for tonight.
D2UDU, Wayne.
Wayne, recognize anyone else out there want to throw out their call sign and their first name for questions for tonight's technical net? Uh, Okay, very well. Hopefully, as time goes on, more people will come by to offer questions or topics. Otherwise, it might be a rather quiet pre-Christmas episode. Wayne, KD2UDU, what is your question or topic for tonight?
Roy, it's more like a topic. We recently, as of I think last weekend, there was the 10-meter PQ contest, and I've noticed more increased activity. Today I heard several DX stations on 10 meters, and so I was very pleased. And, I made several contacts, including Brazil and Canada. Today I heard a lot of Canadian stations, actually, in the afternoon. So I was just wondering if you did this DX, the 10-meter DX contest, and what you thought of the propagation improvement.
No, unfortunately, I missed it. This was my day off of 10 meters. Usually, every Sunday, I run the Kings County Radio Club's 10-meter net. That's where I get most of my opportunity to play around in 10 meters. And it's sort of a shame, apparently, because I kind of looked in on the morning, and the morning was kind of quiet. So maybe in the afternoon, if things opened up for 10 meters. Things in my experiences lately have been rather sluggish for 10 meters. About 3 months ago, all of a sudden, something magical happened, and 10 meters opened up. One Sunday morning, we had a whole slew of people from Texas who contacted us, and the following week, it was a smattering of Texas, but we had the Midwest and the South and such. And then all of a sudden, everything went silent, and the farthest station we could pull in was New Jersey. So I'm glad to hear that things opened again later on today. I unfortunately missed it. You take a look at propagation conditions. You take a look at the sunspot cycle, and inevitably, as time goes on, the sunspots will become more and more active, and more of these openings will occur. And This is where you have the opportunity to develop a long a bunch of fish stories telling people that you worked around the world. 10 meters and 6 meters is a magic band during sunspot maximums, which we're going into as time goes on. So I'm glad that you got a lot of contacts. I'm trying to think if I ever – I think I once reached Canada – we had some very weird experiences. I've been at the 10-meter net for about 5-6 years now, and for some odd reason, it's very difficult to get across that the Nassau County, Queens line. We had it with one gentleman who set up a station in Fire Island, but with the exception of that one guy, for the most part, we've always operated much better towards the south than towards the north. It was not unusual, even during the sunspot doldrums, to pick up the occasional Florida station. So I'm glad that you got you were able to tag base with a bunch of Canadians and a lot of DX stations. I guess I should have stayed tuned on 10 meters after noon time.
I actually check it several times a day, when I'm off. And because I do like it's not as crappy as 20 meters, and I check the other, I check 17 meters and I check 12 meters and 15 meters also, just because it's less crowded, so it's sometimes easier to make a contact. I'm only using 20 watts, so it's hard to get through on a big pile up. But for some reason today, like I said, I heard. Basically, Western Canada, Calgary, Alberta, Saskatchewan, and they were coming in really loud, and there was quite a pile up for them. But they were very strong. I was wishing I had a little more power than 20 watts, but it was difficult to get through to them.
Yeah, I pretty much got into the habit of using my linear amplifier when I'm doing 10 meters. When it's you know, when conditions are poor, and I'm just talking to people on the ground wave propagation, it's probably a little too much. So I've cranked it down to the minimum setting of my linear amplifier, which is about 400 watts or so. If propagation is decent, but I'm not really reaching people, I can crank it as far up as 1300 watts. It's a shame. The propagation conditions are erratic, and I think to a degree that's partially the allure of amateur radio. If it was as consistent as a cell tower, people wouldn't be quite as fascinated with it. And so, you know, you have all kinds of different methods. You have beacons, reverse beacons, you have DX spotters, and you have guys who just kind of send you messages on your phone saying, by the way, I just noticed that 10 meters was lively. So there's many, many, many different ways of inspecting 10 meters locally and generally in the region. I guess I have to make myself a little bit more aware of that.
Yeah, Roger. Yeah, I try and spread myself out between 20, 17, and 10. 17 meters, for some reason this morning, I was getting a lot of England on 17 meters. I don't know why, but it's nice to see that, you know, the propagation improving across the band.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that we've all looked forward to. I tell the story of this unfortunate kind of depressed guy in New Jersey. I talked to him a couple of years ago, and that was when there was this rumor that the sunspot cycles were going to somehow work their way to negate this this cycle, and this cycle would be a bust entirely, and you know. Because that's the nature of things. People kind of oversell something and then they undersell it. It's a pendulum. And the poor guy was very depressed. His attitude was that he was getting on in years, and this was really, as far as he could see, the last big sunspot maximum that he could rely upon. And he was talking about just selling his equipment and retiring from the hobby. So I don't think it's going to be like that. I think we're going to have a decent... The last sunspot cycle was a little weird. It was kind of biphasic. It was two little humps instead of one big hump. But I don't think there's anything to indicate that this coming cycle is going to be any particular different than previous ones. It most likely won't be the strongest, but it won't be the weakest either. So I'm really, really, really looking forward to the propagation conditions that leads to. When 10 meters is awake, I fill up a couple of papers with contacts from the 10-meter net. Otherwise, when they're bad like they have been the last month or so, I end up talking to about three people locally. So I'm very optimistic. I'm very hopeful, and the only time will tell.
Roger. I'm optimistic also. You know, I'm a fairly recent ham, so the only cycle that I can recall was when I was on the TV back in the 80s, and I do recall, you know, the skip, you know, the DX would be rolling in. So, you know, sometimes 10 o'clock at night, it was still rolling in on 11 meters. So I'm looking forward to that kind of activity again. As far as 10 meters, one of the Canadian stations was, like, calling for more people to be active, basically saying that the band isn't as dead as you might think. It's just because nobody's using it, and if you start using it, you'll hear more people. And it made sense because I was hearing more and more people today.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's often the case. If everyone has the sense that there's nothing going on the band, there's no activity, and you can't tell the difference between poor propagation and lack of activity. You have to have both, but it's sort of the chicken and the egg, you know, which came first. That's why all these modern conveniences of alerting people when bands open should be kind of promoted and spread far and wide, so that when the opportunity avails itself, more people will be aware and more people will be likely to tune in and check it out. You know, I mean, I love the idea of using my Flex radio. I have pan adapters, so I can just bring it up and see the general RF activity on most of the HF bands. But most guys have to kind of sit there and twirl their knobs and listen closely to get a better sense of the activity going on. So the more spotting methods available, the better.
I have to admit I am a little spoiled. I have the waterfall feature on the 5090, the Daigo 90 that I've been using. And it's really good. You know, you can see a good portion of the band to see if there's any activity, and then and tune to it, you know, if you see it, like a big spike with, you know, a lot of white color. It's usually a strong signal. So, I'm spoiled in that respect. I still haven't gotten the Kenwood 511 up and running. It receives, but very, very low, very poor audio in the receive area. And I'm probably going to replace some more tubes. I already replaced the driver circuit because that is part of the receive also. But I'm thinking of just... including the final tubes are expensive. Those are $80 a piece, so we'll probably do that later. But and that would solve the problem of breaking through pileups, because that puts out 150 watts or so. So that would definitely help me in that regard.
KD2 FIU.
Yes, George. By the way, this is AC2GS. But yes, George.
And good evening, Roy, and thank you for bringing me in. Wayne, I owe you an email about one of the approaches to that. And yesterday evening, I was talking with somebody on the West Coast who had his first radio was the 511. And he said that the receive, I said, you know, is the receive weak on this or not? He said, incredibly strong receive. And in indicating, he said, no, there is a trouble and it's not hard to find. And his first radio was the 511, and probably he had it in the late 70s, and he sold it to go on to other Kenwood tube radios at the time. So, I do owe you an email with one approach. I just wanted to mention that. And also, getting through it, when you do get through it, it's going to be a very appreciated radio. Thank you, Roy. And back to Net Control.
You're welcome, George. Let me check that I have it. Okay. That poor 511. We've been hearing about that 511 for, has it been a year, Wayne? It seems like a year. It strikes me as a wonderful tool to learn how radios work and how radios don't work. I mean, it would be lovely eventually to hear good stories that it made you contacts. I don't know. It certainly is not for the weak at heart, who just want to plug in a radio, turn it on, and talk to the world. But I certainly do wish you a great deal of luck with it. I understand that the tubes are rather expensive. They're not in ready supply, and so they cost a bit.
Roger, Roy. This is KD2UDU. Yeah, the final tubes, the LQ6 tubes are like $80 a piece. All the other tubes are barely inexpensive, as far as I can see. So I'm going to replace them first. I also ordered some deoxid because I'm having an issue with the meter. The meter is pegged no matter what setting I put it in, you know, the switch that determines what the meter is reading doesn't seem to be working, and the meter is always pegged. So I want to clean that switch, and I'm also going to clean the volume control with the deoxys and see if that helps that too. But, you know, I originally bought the radio with the intention that, hey, you know, I'm a ham operator, and I should know this, and if I don't know it, I'm going to have to learn it. And so I was kind of prepared for a learning experience, for lack of a better, you know. I didn't want to just buy a radio and plug it in, which is actually gratifying because I did that too. But my intention initially was just to learn about radios by fixing this one. Back to you.
AC2GS. Well, it certainly does give you an opportunity to learn a lot, and I'm sure you have learned a lot with the help of people like George and Andy, WA2CDL, learning a lot of the ins and outs of the radio. Deoxit's a very good thing to have. I have a can sitting about, I'd say, about 2 feet away from me, and it's a very useful thing to have available for all kinds of stuff, for amateur radio equipment, but for anything that have switches that could get a little fudgy and such. They clean them up very, very nicely. So, yeah, deoxit is certainly a good idea to get some of that just for the shack and just for general use. And you kind of remind me of amateur radio operators of the old time. They could fix all kinds of things. I still remember about 3 or 4 years ago we had a gentleman who showed up who was very annoyed. He had bought with his credit card a radio, nice, shiny, brand new, taken it out of its box, plugged it in, plugged in the necessary connections, turned the power on, and he was very upset that he was considered an amateur. He wanted to be considered a professional, I guess. He didn't quite understand. Professionals get paid, and I don't know about you, but I don't get paid for any of this. And also, amateurs is a nice word. It's Latin for a lover. You know, we all love radios, and that's why we're doing this. But it's good to understand how they work, and that's one of the many reasons why this technical net exists.
KG2RY.
Thank you again.
Okay, very good, Wayne. Thank you for participating. Thanks for your comment. And, again, I wish you a great deal of luck with the 511. I know eventually you are going to get that thing to sing. Now, I recognize David and Wesley. So, David, I heard first. So, David, what is your comment?
My comment for Wayne is if you start with a radio that's in 100% working condition, then you can optimize the antenna and you can optimize all the parts so that you can make the contacts and, you know, without too much of a frustration of it, you know, that's what I did, and it seems to work okay. I guess it depends on what you're looking for, what you want to get out of it. KG2RY.
Okay, good point, David. You know, it's kind of like philosophy, and I hate to turn this back into the philosophy net, but, you know, some people like to teach people how to swim from the shallow end, and other people, for a whole bunch of different reasons, prefer to teach them how to swim at the deep end. I think Wayne got more of the deep end philosophy in, you know, repairing a great radio in its time that had kind of been smacked around a wee bit too much. But, you know, you gain a lot more insight that way. It causes more frustrations and requires much, much more effort. But at the end of the day, when you finally got it going, you probably have a greater degree of self-satisfaction that you took something that was limping and turned it into a sprinter. So, you know, it depends on the individual. I mean, I tend not to buy used stuff unless there's a good reason for me to buy the used stuff, because I feel that I'm buying someone else's problem. But I can understand, you know, you could get inexpensive stuff and you get a good education along with it. So, you know, different strokes for different folks.
Yeah, but, you know, these days there's so many choices. You have so many choices. Even a new little radio, you know, can do so much more than my old Kenwood Twins did back in 1974, 75, you know, and the features on the new one and the new technology and the cost, you know, these are all, I think, considerations.
No, I agree with you, David. If you take a look at the Sherwood, the famous Sherwood receiver specs list, engineer by the last name, I assume, of Sherwood, has put together, tested hundreds of different radios, got their specifications, wrote them down, put them on a list, put them in order, and if you look at the high spec list, they're all relatively new designs. Electrical engineering has improved over the years. Tolerances and sophisticated circuits have dropped in price, and so you don't need the old legacy components to get the high specifications for receivers. And so the modern receivers are relatively inexpensive, relatively light, relatively durable, and relatively inexpensive. But, you know, some people want to have their Drake radios, and for them, fine, wonderful. I understand. I understand the allure of the old Collins radio. If you take a Collins radio and put it next to a relatively inexpensive, something like a ICOM 7300, I think the 7300 would blow the Collins completely away. You know, the VFO is locked on and not changing, and that's probably not quite the case with a wonderful Collins. But, you know, different people want different models for different reasons.
Yeah, I think it's a choice. And you got to be careful, you know, looking at some of these new radios, you know, with the SDR built in, you wonder, you know, if there is some hype there, and then whether there is some value there, you know. And I don't know. I think that, you know, these, what do they call them, LCD screens, you know, I'm a little bit weary of these TVs on the ham radio gear. And maybe, you know, for me, the right radio is one that doesn't have the LCD, but is like brand new.
Okay, I mean, that's an aesthetic choice more than anything else. Pretty much all modern, major modern radios that I can think of off the top of my head have fundamentally a liquid crystal display. They may organize the display in kind of an old-fashioned meter and light indicator version, and not just do a pan adapter. Although I don't know. I mean, personally, having a radio that has a pan adapter, it's very difficult in my mind to go backwards. I mean, I have a beautiful IC7100 that I'm using this very, very moment, but it really doesn't have anything vaguely related to a pan adapter. So you're back to kind of tuning stuff and listening with your headset, which some of the old timers say is the only way to do it. I would disagree respectfully. I really like the visual interface. It's unfortunate Some of our fellow hams are handicapped. They're legally blind, and they really don't get much of any information based visually. And so that visual aspect of modern-day radios isn't really valuable to them. But for the rest of us that can see, pan adapters make life incredibly easier. You take a look at the band and you see where it's active. I can recognize the difference between different modes. I can see AM. I can recognize FM. I can recognize single sideband. It's nice. It's a nice feature.
QSL. I know this woman. She was from Eastern Europe, Russia, I don't know. I told her I was a ham radio operator. She said, do you have one of those things that have a waterfall on it? You know, the pixels can have problems. I don't want problems with my pixels. And I just want to say that, you know, I have very small radio, small speakers, small tuners, small dual band radio, a couple of small screens hooked up to hotspots. Bit computer takes up most of the space with the AV Pro Audio speakers and the hard drives. But, you know, all told, you know, it all fits onto a door that lost like 9 inches from the top. So, you know, it's a perfect setup for me. I wouldn't say for anybody else. And even like today, I was listening. There's nothing going on for most of the day for me. And then on 15 meters, I heard some guys having a QSO with the, I ended up talking to this man in Belize for like half an hour, and it was really very nice. And I never, ever make contacts on 15 meters.
AC2GS. Well, that's good. You know, I mean, if you don't look, you don't find. And so I'm glad that you found some activity on 15 meters. I've kind of looked at 15 meters. I've never actually, I can't recall having a conversation yet on it. I guess I have to look at that more often. Getting back to your statement about pixels, I would think that the last problem with amateur radio displays would be pixels. Pixels are a major problem when it's on a computer screen and you're looking at some kind of a document or something and there's a couple of dead pixels going on someplace and you kind of see them. But the nature of pan adapters, the light just kind of twinkles all over the place. I would think that you could drop out a whole bunch of pixels and not really notice it too much. So I've never had that experience remarked to me. My pixels that I deal with are on my computer screen anyway. My Flex doesn't have its own much of a screen. It has a little indicator screen, but the pan adapter and the software all run on my PC. So it's a function of my display, not the radio itself. But I'm glad to hear that someone heard the amateur radio and knew what you were talking about. A couple of years ago at one of my local club meetings, a cleanup crew member passed by and said, "What is this?" And I said, it's a meeting of an amateur radio group. And she said, "Amateur radio?" She thought for a moment and she said, "So you play records? Is that what you do?" So, you know, we need to better publicize our hobby.
Yeah, so you get a picture of an Elecraft K4 with that big LCD screen, you know, or maybe, you know, some radio with a very large LCD screen, you know. You create some kind of publicity, you know. People can see the waterfall and they know that it's ham radio.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there are places that you can go and you can look it up. You certainly can Google it. You can do YouTubes. I was disappointed. I have kind of looked into Twitch, which is a streaming service owned by Amazon's Bezos that started as a gamer's site to stream people playing games and became a kind of a general streaming site. There was a guy there that was listed as an amateur radio operator, so I followed him. And after about 3 months of not publishing any streams whatsoever, I guess he had given up and stopped doing it. I unfollowed him. But there are places to look it up, but a lot of people don't even know to look it up. And so generally speaking, if you just do a random question out in Midtown, what is amateur radio, I'm sure you're not going to get that many correct answers, unfortunately.
Well, if you start with the word communication and or technology, underneath communication you would have ham radio, you would have like social media, you would have cellular telephones and technology, you know, like that, and you choose which one. And I do all of them. I do all of them. And I couldn't live without any of them, you know. I'm not so much interested in the one-way communication where all you can do is listen. I think it's great that, you know, ham radio operators can also talk and transmit the signal, which, it's a really great thing.
Yeah, I would agree. I know someone who points out regularly that a people's FCC license doesn't license them to listen to the amateur radio bands. It licenses them to transmit on the amateur bands. I tend to veer in the other direction. I tell people that usually of all the ratios I've considered, listening, 10 times more than you talk is probably a good thing. And I even quote Jimi Hendrix's line about wisdom is listening, not talking. Although we kind of break that rule for things like the technical net, but nevertheless. I think it's a great technology. I think all the communications technologies are intriguing and interesting. Some people listen too little. Some people perhaps listen too much. Everyone has to decide on their own little optimal ratios.
I find that I get the most wisdom when I listen to people who are gifted and have tremendous either spiritual ability or knowledge of a subject, or someone who has a lot of experience in one thing or another. Since we're talking about ham radio, you know, if there's such a thing as a ham radio guru, you know, someone who can inspire you or anybody and offer them something much bigger than they could ever count or imagine.
Yeah, I agree with you. Sometimes it's difficult to figure out who really knows his stuff and who knows a lot of polysyllabic words. The gentleman who did the doctors in for the ARRL and QST, Joel Hallis, is a wonderful example. Dick K2RIW was another wonderful example. These guys just could go on and on and on and on and tell you all these great things that they've discovered all through the very years. And then occasionally you got guys who just sort of pass on old maid tales. We've discussed it in the past on the technical net where people caution other people not to leave their excess coax cable coiled up relatively neatly, but tell them that it has to be rather serpentine, otherwise it acts as a choke for their transmissions, which is nonsense. And others who say that there's optimum lengths for transmission line and all kinds of things that are discussed, especially on 75 meters and 40 meters. There seems to be a lot of the old wives' tales being passed back and forth.
KG2RY. Yeah, I use ferrite beads on the antenna side. And on the shack side, I took away the MFJ choke, and I had much better response for SWR. So I don't have an RF choke in the shack.
Okay, that's your option. If it works for you, that's great. Usually RF chokes will only affect common mode distribution. So the transmission line is a differential mode current. So anything that blocks common mode should not impact on your reception. But again, whatever works for you.
QSL. But, you know, I was looking into this because, you know, the SWR was for some time, how to say, it wasn't 100% stable. It would go off, it would go down. The SWR on the tuner and the radio were slightly different. And I tried taking things out and putting things in to see how it would work. And I took out the signal enhancer noise eliminator, and that helped a lot. And then I took out the MFJ choke, and I just put in a barrel connector. And it seems to work fantastic, so I don't complain for that. But it would be very difficult for someone to figure all of that out, just even that, if they're still in the process of fixing their radio.
Well, that's true. You can't tweak a system that doesn't work. You unfortunately have to fix what's broken, and then once everything is operational, then you have an opportunity to tweak and finesse the little details. So it sort of depends on where you want to start from and where you want to go to and what experiences you want to have. Most of us do not have a great deal of experience ultimately repairing the innards of our radio. We can swap a fuse, we can swap a vacuum tube. On a good day, we can detect a faulty capacitor and swap that out. But a lot of the things, especially nowadays with surface mount technology, it requires a real fiddly ability to do without the proper equipment to do surface mount repairs. I just the other day heard a guy very technically adept perform an operation on his Kenwood a handy talkie, removing a surface mount and replacing it. But yeah, the average Joe, that would be a big problem. It's not very easy to do, and it's very easy to ruin the discrete component attempting to do it with something like a soldering iron.
WB2VAV.
Yes, Ed.
Yeah, I would just send mine to the Midwest repair shop. They fix it and send it back to me.
Yeah, that's the way it works for most of us now. We send it to technicians and repair shops. Ed, EAV, you wanted to make a comment?
Yeah, very quick comment. If you want to repair a surface mount circuit board, if it's 50,000 inch space, if you're careful, you can do it. Anything smaller than that, you want not doing it freehand.
Okay, Ed, but I'll add a nuance to it, a bigger pain in the backside. It's not only the how small you could build surface mount devices, but they're not all kind of binary, you know, with contacts on either end and a sort of small bar shape. Especially the IC that I was thinking of that the gentleman fixed for himself is, I think, called a quad contact architecture. So it's a bunch of metal contacts underneath a small integrated circuit. So those are a real pain in the backside.
Agreed, 100%. No, I'm just talking about the so-called SO8, which is an 8-pin IC four on the side, 50,000 spacing, which is half the spacing of the famous dips. And those, if you're careful, you can do. Once you start having tighter spacing or weird spacing or anything like that, you're not doing it by hand.
Well, unless you have the proper equipment. If you have a reheating tool and you have some flux and you have some solder paste and you have a very, 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 very steady hand, you might be able to do surface mount. I wouldn't recommend for most people other than the what you were talking about to kind of do this with a even a needle pointed soldering iron. It's best to use a reheating tool if you're going to be doing any kind of or if you tend to want to learn to do surface mount repairs.
My experience is with all the stuff you've described, you got at best a 50-50 chance of the patient surviving the operation. Without that, 0%.
Okay, with some people's old equipment, 50-50 is reasonably good odds. So I'm sure there are more than a few people who would go with those odds. Yeah, I mean, some people just have a great deal, amount of pleasure and accomplishment in fixing things despite the risks. So, you know, I give them credit for that. They have more, I don't think I would do that because if I wrecked it, I would be very, very annoyed at me. Sometimes I've done things more out of ignorance of how difficult it is. And when I got away with it, I had a great deal of satisfaction. I kind of was wondering why the hell I tried to do that. As an example, I had a laptop that was out of warranty completely. And the fluorescent, the fluorescent lamp, burnt out. So I decided for some stupid reason to replace it. Took about a day and a half. Had to disassemble the entire LCD display short of, removing the different, layers of the panes of glass, which would probably wreck it irretrievably. And put it all back, and the damn thing actually worked. But, you know, sometimes, again, if I would have realized how problematic that would be, I think that would end up being a 50-50 type of thing as well. I probably wouldn't have done it. I did it. I gave the laptop to my nephew. He put it under his bed, jumped on his bed, and broke it. So be it.
I was laughing too hard to comment.
Yes, well, what can you do? I mean, the youths of today.
And to extend.
Yes, Wesley.
Put me next. Subject antenna.
Okay, consider yourself next, antennas. I'm guessing that you're going to be talking about ferrite and coils and such, because that's what you've been sending me, so okay. Anyone with any comments on this subject, though, before we move on? Yes, William. Nice to hear you on this repeater.
Hey, Roy, just checking in to find out if it works both ways, but I've been listening to the net, and it works, so that's fantastic. Anyway, I don't have anything to offer. I think the next guy is, I want to hear what he says about antenna, so back to net control.
Okay, William. Well, if you're interested, you have about 30% noise on your signal, but it's very readable. So continue listening and enjoy yourself.
KGDD.
Yes, David?
You know, I think it's about knowing what you want, you know, to have a clear idea of what you want and also knowing what you don't want and somehow coming to a decision about what you want, specifically with regard to the kind of radio you want to buy and what you need to do to make it 100% functional. And I guess, you know, everybody has a different idea of what they want, but I think they all want the same amount of fulfillment and satisfaction.
AC2GS. Well, I would agree with you in principle, David. The problem is that getting to that destination, it's a different journey for everyone. So what gives me satisfaction might not be identical to what it gives you or Ed or Wesley or William. And there are a lot of roads that lead to Rome. So what we each have to kind of look in on ourselves and figure it out. Now, sometimes, especially here on the TechNet, there's enough people that you could bounce things off of and you get a good sense of what's available, what can be done, what should be done, what shouldn't be done. The problem I find with new guys in the hobby is they lack so much knowledge on the subject because they didn't expose themselves to it yet that they don't even know what the proper questions are. So if you don't know the questions, you certainly will not find the answers. So a knowledgeable person will know the right questions, be able to find the right answers, and hopefully be very happy with their decision. I know people who settle on a design for a shack, and it stays that way for years and years and years, and I know other guys who just get tired of stuff, and they trade up, down, and sideways almost every time I contact them, it's a different radio I'm talking through on their end. So, again, different strokes. This is a very interesting hobby in that it's very wide and it's very deep. Whereas coin collecting, as far as I'm concerned, is just coin collecting, and stamp collecting is just stamp collecting. There's a lot of different ways to express amateur radio technology, and just among the people who participate in our weekly technical net, you can see there's a difference of approaches to all of the people who check in, who tend to prefer one mode over another, and one aspect of the technology over another, and you know, it's an interesting hobby in that way and many other ways.
QSL, Roy, I encourage people to get more of what they want from the hobby and to know what that is, you know? Part of the process is to gain the knowledge. So you know that you can get more of what you want and less of what you don't want, and maybe have more experiences that are extremely fulfilling, you know, extremely inspiring, you know, beyond, above and beyond what they say in the book. And I encourage people to go there.
Okay, very good. That's an excellent idea. Let me mention that one of our EchoLink participants, AB6MB, Jeff, who is the net control operator for the Papa Systems antenna net every Friday night, 10 o'clock our time, would like to comment about the Rob Sherwood talk, of the same gentleman who keeps the Sherwood list. So let's drop the repeater for a second or two, give him an opportunity to key up, and tell us about it. Oh, well, I guess Jeff has stepped away. He's still active on the Echo Link, but he made that comment about 12 minutes ago, so who knows what happened. Maybe we'll try again later on. So, Wesley, you want to discuss the nuances of loop antennas?
Yeah, well, actually, there is some kind of controversy in 2XGN. I've sent you first the video about the guy QROCW. So his YouTube nickname is QROCW. QRO is capital, CW is small, lowercase. And the guy is describing a very low frequency receiving antennas that use a massive ferrite core, that's what they call it. And nothing special, but then I've noticed that he's using the term bipolar. Resonating the bipolar Tesla coil, a bipolar antenna, bipolar. Okay, so what the heck is that?
Yeah, I think it's pronounced bipolar.
Thank you very much for correcting my English. Bipolar, okay, bipolar. Yeah, but what bipolar has to do with it, with antennas? So then I sent you the email, but shortly before the net, yeah, I look at it again and again, I see bipolar Tesla coil or bipolar antenna. And although I'm not trying to be a person scrutinizing other ham radio operator, I look at it closely, and the shortest reference at first that I found was that bipolar is being used for the stepper motors windings, and when we have a bipolar winding for the motors, the current flows through one entire winding in alternating direction, and the driver circuitry, then in switching, and four transistor per winding whatsoever. And then we have a unipolar configuration. I'm not going to go into it. But then the next source I found was the bipolar winding of the center tape of the top of the transformer. So yes, but we have one winding of the transformer, and then we have a center top of it. And then we could say that it's a kind of bipolar wound transformer, half of the tunes of the coil adding a center top, then winding the rest of the turns. Anyhow, I'm gonna send you the link that I don't have. Didn't send you yet. But then I got into something that was really, really interesting. The CIA. Okay. Once I got into the low frequency antennas, and I was looking at some work of ham radio operators, I went to VK5BR, that is Lloyd Butler. He discusses everything that is associated with loop antennas, and he's comparing the loop antennas with the ferrite-based antennas. Everybody remembers the old type of radio receivers for AM using a ferrite inside. And Butler made a few publications in Ham Radio magazine, I'm not sure if it's QSL, but he made a quite nice work, VK5BR, in it, and he not only described the differences and how